What's good? We back live for Vietnam. And sorry, I was running a little bit late. Had some issues. The StreamYard wasn't working. And then we had a breaker go out, so we had to get a breaker change. And we had a special guest waiting, and we about to bring him on. A lot of y'all cats definitely know about this cat if you know real hip-hop. He worked with Master Ace back in the days. He's a producer and a rapper. Produced a lot of records for a lot of cats. Let's bring on the one and only Lord Digga.
Yes, sir. How you doing, man? We live for Vietnam. I'm good, bro.
You been through here before? You been through Fayetteville, North Carolina before?
I think we have, like, back.
You probably did.
But, yeah. And, you know, because, back, rap was still connecting, you know, as far as other regions, you know, if it wasn't certain areas that were, you know, really supportive for, especially East Coast music at that time, you know, if he wasn't like super big in the sense of, you know, MTV and stuff of that nature, which we later did anyway, but, you know, you might not be recognized and you might not make it into those areas back then, like a Fayetteville and, you know, places of that nature. But North Carolina is since the 90s, North Carolina has come up anyway. It's way bigger than it, you know what I'm saying, it was back then. But I'm from the South anyway, so I already know. The South
part?
You know, that's my shit. I'm from Florida.
What part are you from?
Originally, I'm from Florida. I'm from Miami. Yeah, I'm from
that
Miami.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I'm from fucking Miami. So I moved to New York. I moved up north in 1983 was my final time moving. I was going back and forth as a younger kid. I wanted to be with my mom. She was in New York, but I didn't like New York because of I couldn't see. Like, you know, the buildings and the shit, you know, the South, you can see like fucking 10 miles in front of you. Right. So, you know, I was trying to get accustomed to that type of shit. And, you know, it was just different. You know, I was used to playing in grass in the South and you came up here, it's concrete everywhere, you know, so it was just weird. So I would travel back and forth until finally, you know, I decided in 83 that, okay, I'm going to just stay. So I've been there ever since.
So let's go back to when you were a kid. What were some of your biggest musical influences?
It was, a lot of my music, you know, younger was in Florida. So, you know, we didn't have any fucking rap music. You know, Florida didn't really pop off with rap until after I actually left, which was Luke Skywalker. So, right. So, you know, early influences was really my cousins because, ironically, that's kind of funny I said Luke Skywalker because it all ties in. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, they used to do mobile DJ groups. And they used to go around and play music outside of like stores and shit like that and in the parks. You used to have to get a permit from the city to do it.
Okay.
And in those mobile DJ groups was Luke Skywalker. He had a mobile DJ group called Ghetto Style DJs. And I used to roll with my cousins that used to be the Opa-Locka DJs. From out of Opa-Locka, Florida, Miami. So that's where the early musical influence came because they were in a record pool. So you already know, record pool, you're going to get music from everywhere. Now, you know, they're gradually starting to play rap, but it wasn't the slow, groovy shit at that time. We still was, you know, working with a lot of rap that was with, you know, had a lot of speed. We're talking about, you know, Planet Rock, all of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So any of that type of stuff, that's what they were playing. So that's where my early influences came from. Just being with my cousin, shout out to my cousin, Almighty C, Opa-Locka DJs. And yeah, that's basically where it started. But then, you know, it went on from there to when my mother actually bought me the first rap record, which was, I think, labeled at the time, it was King Tim III and the Fatback Band. She bought me that record on a 45. It was a 45. And she told me, I think this was like, maybe like 79, maybe.
That's the year I was born.
She told me that this, That's crazy. So that she told me that this is what's going on in New York. This is what's going on. Like, you know, like this is the scene in New York for music. So I kind of liked it and I was trying to get more attached to it. So from there, you know, being not even knowing how big the culture was going to be or whatever it was, I didn't even know what hip hop was at that time. I just wanted to do something. So I started dancing and shit. So that's how I started connecting to hip hop. I was a breaker, pop locker, whatever the hell. I don't know what the term is at that time, because especially coming from Florida, it was different. So I was doing that and I entered into a lot of dance contests. They had a lot of dance contests and I won like every one of them shit. So by the time I came to New York, yo, I was seasoned with some other type of dance skills because our influences were from, what was those shows back then that they were, the dance fucking shows with Casey Kasem and all of them fucking people. I forgot the name of them.
I know what you're talking about. Forgot what they called too, yeah.
Dance Machine. It was a bunch of shit that had that influence and had a lot of dancing in it outside of Soul Train. And, you know, Florida was influenced by California and New York with that. So that's where a lot of my dancing style and shit came from long before me doing any music. But it all came from Florida, though.
So many people know you as both an MC and a producer. Which one came first?
Producer? After I got to New York, I wanted to find a way to contribute to the culture. So I knew, you know, I felt that I had a better ear to try to put music together than I had a better science on, actually writing songs. Mm. I was writing stuff down, but I wouldn't say that it was top tier shit. You know, okay. Everybody thinks their shit is dope. When you write down shit, you're like, yo, this shit is dope. Yeah. Their first raps is like the best of them. If they listen back to them shits 20 years, they'd be like cringing in their fucking seat.
No good. So, yeah.
Right. It's like, what the fuck was I trying to say? Like, what the fuck was that? So at the same time, you know, I figured if I'm going to try to get into this shit, let's try to see the fastest way to try to do it is contributing in a way where, you know, I got something to offer, not me asking somebody to offer me something. You understand? Like, yo, what can you do for me? Rolling up on people, yo, put me on. Well, if I have something to offer, I can get myself on. So, yeah, the production was definitely first.
The question I think probably everybody asks, you probably hear this one all the time, but how did the connection with Master Ace and the INC crew come about?
We all went to the same high school, but in different time frames. Okay.
Okay.
So leader of the group was in high school first. And it was a school, Sheepshead Bay High School out in Brooklyn. So he was there. He was a senior. I came in as a freshman. He was leaving. But two of the three members of Ice U Rock was also in the school too. So now you take Unique from Ice U Rock. He was the younger brother to Ice from Ice U Rock. So he also came into the school, but then he was behind me. You understand? So he's younger than me.
Yeah.
So we all were staggered. So Ice was older than me. So it was all like it was weird. It was like a big staggered point. So at some point, we all they were actually in a group before me. They was in this group called the Come Alive 5 MCs or something like that. And, you know, I wasn't rapping then at all. I was dancing still. I was on some pop locking shit. But, so that's how we all met. And another connection to it all, outside of Unique, we all played on the fucking football team. So that was another connection. You know, so that's basically how we ended up linking with him. And, you know, by the time I'm graduating high school, he's already working on his first record. You know, that's like 88.
Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, linking up with Marley and then eventually, you know, y'all know the story.
So y'all had this sound. It was, I guess it was kind of like New York Jeep bass music, but it was called Brooklyn bass music. Who came up with that sound? Because that sounds like a mixture of Florida. It does sound like a mixture of Florida and New York when you think about it.
Because, yeah, when you think about the Southern music in Florida back, it was, you know, 808s and, you know, a lot of low holds, low hertz tones and shit to create that bass that they like to drive around with in their trunk. So basically what we did was, it was like a combination of like low end theory mixed in with harder, you know, concepts of music.
Yeah,
you know, Tribe Called Quest was on the metal, on the more of a mellow side.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was kind of like more like that. I wouldn't even say Southern, but it was like a low end theory type of thing with the bass and that type of stuff mixed in with like, yeah, like you would say, like the California vibe, and that's what created the Brooklyn bass.
Now was that a collection?
We even had that song.
Huh? Was it a collection of y'all that came up with that sound, or was it, or did you come up with that sound?
You know, it ended up being a collection, because once we kind of figured out where he was going, what he wanted to do, and where he was trying to take the music, we started creating stuff that be similar to, you know, that style. So we would go in and, you know, and create that type of stuff. Blues Brothers and a collective group of the other producers that would try to cater to that sound after the first album, after the first, you know, after the Slaughterhouse album on Delicious Vinyl. So it was more prevalent too on the second album, which was, you know, Sitting on Chrome. Because he tried to come up with a formula to try to create, you know, to keep creating stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. And you basically,
I was kind of pissed off.
Why is that?
Because I felt that was one side of it. That was one style of it. But you got, you know, other people you got to cater to, which would be more New York instead of now. You know, at that time, you got to understand it. Now everything is more grouped together. Back at that time, when we're talking about things in a territorial type of thing, musically and everything. Yeah. So when we're talking about, you're repping for your city and your town, California does it the best. They've done it the best all the time. It doesn't matter what song that they put out in California. They could do California 15 times, that same concept of California, and it's still going to rep California no matter what. And we at that time, I just thought that we just needed to rep more New York in the sense of now putting out music that was mine and Paula's, as well as him doing what he was doing. So that's kind of like how we kind of like fell out at the beginning, you know, creative differences.
Yeah.
About what should have been done.
And that's what was going to be actually my next question is like, why'd y'all have a fallout? Was it creative differences? Because if not, usually it's all about money after that. If it's not creative differences, it's money issues usually.
Or both
sometimes, you know.
Right. I'm going to say it was both.
Both?
Mixed in with, it was both mixed in with some, I would say some inner jealousy type of stuff. And then when you having that from the leader, it's going to be kind of difficult for everybody else to flourish in the group. You know, we could keep a smile on our face and everybody see everything functioning and everybody thinks that everything is good. But at that time, nobody's going to, you know, it was a job, you know, it's a career, but at the same time, it's a job. This is what is putting money in our pockets. This is what's now, you know, getting us to travel around the world and things of that nature. So nobody at that time is going to just try to implode and blow up everything and say, yo, you know, this is not right and this is that. So, you know, the creative differences and, also, you know, money. You know, a lot of people don't understand that some of us contributed more than just rapping, you know, and I would be one of them. You understand? Well, yeah, like, yeah, if you yeah. look at You understand? Like, I was almost on every song.
Yeah.
On both albums. So, you know, no matter whether it was just my voice saying this, whether it was Digga Dome, whether it was whatever, I was somewhere, somehow, I was the new revolutionized Flavor Flav, if you want to put it like that. You understand?
Yeah.
Without the
Yeah, because you were considered a hype man at the time, right?
Yeah, but I don't... Somewhat, but see, you know the you know that terminology, hype man? Right. You know the thing with the hype man thing where I kind of beg to differ with the terminology of it, because I think a hype man is someone that comes out before the show and gets the crowd hype and says whatever.
Yeah.
If you're on if you're on the actual record, I don't consider that a hype man. And Flavor was on those records, and I was on those records outside of my slow. I have more solo records on albums than Flavor has with Public Enemy. But at the same time, we contributed to the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you know, with him with the outburst and motherfuck John Wayne and all that other stuff. So that was similar to some of the stuff that I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, with the Digga Dome and the this and that and, you know, all of that stuff, it was more than just being in the group. You understand? You're contributing to the whole, to everything. It's not just, oh, show up and rap. You know, the same hours he spent in the studio is the same hours I spent in the studio. It wasn't just like he called me to come and do this and then I bounced. He was there till 3 a.m. I was there till 3 a.m. So it was it's way different than you just calling some people together to say, yo, let's put this fucking group together and we're going to go make some music. No. It was way different than that. We, like I said, we knew, you know, this guy since high school. It wasn't just like we just ran to him at some show and he said, yo, look, I like these guys. I want to put them on. You know, I seen these group of guys. I was doing this show and I want to put them on. So it was different. So, you know, the fallout, you know, like you said, it could be both. And it was creative differences, because I felt at the time when we did Sitting on Chrome that it should have been B-side. That should have been the single with showcasing all of us. Because B-side was the B-side of Sitting on Chrome, and that should have been either that record or it should have been the main chain record that we did, that me and Ace did. I felt that that should have been the two next singles, because we are a group. And outside of Saturday Night Live, we had no other, you know, things that were showcasing a group. That was it.
Yeah.
Other than you hearing my voice, contrary like I said, to what I'm people on every think. Record.
Contrary to what people think, that those albums were a collective. You know, it wasn't just one artist did everything. It was definitely a whole collective on those albums and whatnot.
As me and Norm produced, I'm also rapping. You understand? On my own songs. You know, You Can't Find Me. That was one of my first solo songs. But it wasn't pushed. It wasn't considered, I guess, one of my solo songs until we did Crazy Drunken Style. You know, we produced that, and I'm rapping. So it was way more than just, we having a fallout about whatever. We contribute a lot to this situation, so we should have a bigger voice, and we should all come to a vote to say what should be next. It shouldn't just be you and showcasing you. And that was a lot of it. You know, outside of him going and doing, you know, doing some grimy stuff, doing publishing deals with, you know, our shares of publishing that he shouldn't have control over. It was a lot of stuff that was going on from the inside. But see, when you have a bad leader, you know, that usually happens. You know, if your leader's not good, you got to have a good leader.
Yeah.
And if you don't, if your leader, how far can you really go?
And I'm guessing y'all don't talk to this day still?
Nope.
And that's a lot of that's going around. I mean, I interviewed Five Footer recently, Five Footer from Black Moon. And it's like, just hearing some of the things he was saying, like, you start the group and you kind of pretty much get put to the side. You know what I'm saying? It's like, wow, that's crazy. Like, how I start something, y'all just shelf me.
You know what? You know, people get mad at me when I talk about the situation, because it's something that affected me and I had no control over. I would have handled everything differently, because if I'm the person that sees that these people have talent, I'm going to sit back like a Dr. Dre or whoever and try to push the younger talent to the to the people that's out there in the street that want this type of street stuff, that want that rugged stuff. You had two well-capable artists on your roster, you know, meaning Paula Perry and I, that could have pushed that to the next level. You understand? And nobody was rapping like Paula Perry at that time. You know what I'm saying? It was things that was conscious. There was things that was, you know, we had people that was, I would say, you know, in the sense of the Antoinettes and, you know, the Sweet Teas and, you know, Little Kim ain't really, Little Kim wasn't there yet as Little Kim. You know, Biggie was still developing her. So at that time, Paula had a spot where she could have, you know, got into her little groove, and you never know what would have happened. Even though eventually she ended up still getting a deal, but it wasn't the same thing. You know, even down with that, they did some shit to fuck up her deal with that situation. But yeah, like, you know, Ace was even, you know, Ace, you know, he went around the world long before I started going back overseas. I started going back overseas in 2015. So from 1995 all the way through that time, he went and told his story to everybody to make them feel that I was the one that made the group, you know, disband. And I'm like, I'm not the leader of the group, so how could I make the group disband? It wasn't Lord Digga Incorporated. You understand? So that doesn't make sense. And this is what I said about the leader. He doesn't want to own up and take responsibility for what he did, you know, outside of everything else. You know, it was a point where, you know, he even told us that the girls in the group were like our sisters. So how do you end up marrying Lachey? Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You understand? It doesn't make sense. This stuff was going on and we under our noses. You know, they were like Ike and Tina Turner right under our noses. They didn't get into no relationship after the group disbanded. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Because Ike and Tina Turner shit going on. And we just was like, yo, you know, whatever. Not paying attention to it. So, you know, those two basically broke up the group. Basically.
Yeah, I can see that because you start showing favoritism to your girl and stuff when she part of the group and whatnot. I can see that.
There you go. And we're not supposed to know that. And we're not supposed to. I'll give you an incident. One of my remixes, you may know. I did a remix for the Mysterious Misfits.
I remember
that. A song called Upside Down, where I sampled Diana Ross. Upside Down, the song. Nobody was doing stuff like that. All right, cool. Yeah. So before the track went to the Mysterious Misfits, Lachey, at the time, not knowing, like I said, they in relationships and doing all type of crazy stuff. She heard the track and a couple other tracks. So she wanted it. But this was long before she started recording her demos and stuff like that to try to get her a deal. So nobody can claim anything. If you want a track, you were signed to Master Ace's production company, so you need to get him to give me some paperwork stating that, okay, we're taking this track, and I'm going to pay you money for this right now to hold on to this. This track is bought by us. We want this. That never happened.
Yeah.
So now, weeks go by, we get back off the road, and I go into a meeting up at Columbia. And sure enough, yo, we can use that track for a remix for our song. Can we get that? No problem. All right, we got a check for you. $10,000.
Yeah.
So what do you think happened? You know what happened. But here's the thing. Those two tried to make me feel that I gave away her track. Yo, you sold Lachey's track. I was like, what do you mean? Did she record on it yet? It'd be different if she even made a song and then I just lifted the track off her and then gave it to them. You didn't even do nothing. All you said is you wanted it. I want that. What is that? That's window shopping. I'm a producer that has made more money doing production than I've ever made with the INC. So you think that I'm not going to be out here hustling to try to make my money? Are you crazy? I only get, at that time, if we got $5,000, I'm getting what? 10%. $500? A show? Yeah. Really? And then on the production side, I'm getting $10,000 a track? So what are you crazy right now? Like, come on now.
Yeah.
Anybody's gonna do that. I'm not trying to hold on to music for somebody that don't even know whether they want to sing or not. You don't even have anything promising at that time. So, you know, but that's the type of stuff that was going on.
And they probably feel like you're obligated to have to give them the beat because you're part of the same group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. When this person, when the leader was doing things to take money out of our mouths like this, he knew if he produced a track or co-produced a track, that would cut half of our money in half. We were getting $3,000 a track from Delicious Vinyl. So what he did was go and buy machines so that he can make music so he could, we would have less tracks produced on his album. So that's what he did for Sitting on Chrome.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. So you would be worried about me selling a track to Mysterious Misfits and you doing that type of shit? Yeah, all right, bro.
And I'm glad you brought that name up. I totally forgot about them cats. I need to reach out and see if I could get an interview with them cats.
Yo, that's those are my bros, man.
Those are like, that's down my lane of who I'm trying to interview. You know, everybody's like trying to interview mainstream bros, artists and stuff.
Man,
let's get into some of your production. So you co-produce a lot of tracks. You produce a lot of tracks. Do you got a favorite song that stands out to you? Or is there just a song that maybe was just more successful than the rest or something?
Well, you already know what the most successful song that we produce is One More Chance and Biggie. So,
okay. That's a nice one.
Outside of that, I mean, the original version, even though the remix, we still, you know, all, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, the title song, you know, whatever. It's still the same lyrics or whatever. I don't, you know, whatever. But yeah, that would be the biggest. But off the same album, you know, Everyday Struggle is still one of my tops that we did off of Big's album. One of my favorite tracks as well off of, was it Slaughterhouse album? I don't know if it's Slaughterhouse or Signal. Who You Jacking that I did for Paula Perry.
Okay.
It's because of where I got it from and how I chopped it up with the horns and the, like, it was just, yeah, for me, that was one of my first step out productions of me just looping up everything. Like, I'm a great looper and underneath drum putter and snares and hi-hats. Genius at that. So that was one of my first times that I stepped outside of just straight looping something, but taking bits and pieces of the record and just creating, you know, the sound of whatever the fuck that was at that time. That was like really my first time doing it. So that was a good song for me.
You from Florida, but you ended up moving to Brooklyn. I've interviewed a shit ton of Brooklyn rappers on this show. I don't know what it is about Brooklyn, but I guess y'all got a militant mindset or whatnot. What role did Brooklyn play in shaping your sound and your identity?
I think Brooklyn grounded me and just let me see different things because I lived all around Brooklyn. Like, when I first got to New York, we were living in Brownsville. In Riverdale Towers, which is right behind Tilden Houses and Langston Hughes and all of these houses over there, that's the Brooklyn houses and all of these buildings that were over there. And early, you know, I got to be around a lot of that, seeing that. And then, you know, from there, I moved into Flatbush. And then Flatbush was like, oh, shit, it's houses. And then, but still, one of the most notorious projects there is. Vanderveer Houses is less than 70 feet away from me. It's more than 70 feet. I'll say about 800 feet away from me is Vanderveer Houses, which is now one of the most notorious Crip projects there is in Brooklyn. So me connecting with those type of people and then me connecting with my Brownsville people, all of those things. Then plus, you know, I'm already, you know, that the Miami side of where I lived at in Opa-locka, which is one of the more tougher sides in places to live you know, when you're younger, you don't really know all of this. You like, cause you're oblivious to this shit, cause you think you're invisible, so you don't really know, like, how really bad shit is. But now I know, you know, as an adult, I'm like, damn, I was living in places like this, like, what the fuck? But yeah, that type of shit, that shaped me. You know, just seeing the different things and just talking to the different cultures of people, you know, my Jamaican people, my Guyanese people, my Trini people, you know, learning their culture and then just implementing that type of feel throughout the music where, you know, I would try to cater to all that different melting pot of shit in Brooklyn, you know, with the music with this and then the lyrics with this, you know, just try to put all that shit together to make it a perfect marriage, knowing that, yeah, this is a solid foundation of where I created me. You know, I was created in Brooklyn in the sense of me as a artist.
Yeah.
So you are an artist and a producer. What was it like navigating the industry in the 90s as an artist and a producer?
Hard work, because you really had to work, meaning you really had to get on the grind, meaning that word grind was really, it really meant something back then. You know, like, I'm the only producer that didn't have his own equipment.
His own
so
what?
I used to travel. I didn't have my own equipment.
Oh.
Equipment. Okay. I didn't have my own equipment. I had no SP. I had no nothing. Yeah. I had nothing. So I used to go to my friend's house, my voice crib, my dude, Big Ezo. Shout out to Big Ezo. He was the DJ for Nikki D. So okay. I used to go to his basement and start constructing stuff. Go there with my discs, records. I used to leave records over his house. Be like, yo, anything you hear, you make shit, you do whatever. And we ended up start producing for groups, doing all type of stuff. So at the same time, I used to travel to, rest in peace, Norm Glover, aka Witch Doc, which, you know, that was my partner in Blues Brothers. I lived in Flatbush and he lived downtown Brooklyn. So I used to take the train to his house. And at the time, he was married and shit. So we used to be on a time schedule. Like, his wife used to be like, all right, with the ruckus and, you know, you got a certain amount of time to do this and shit. I used to have to go smoke weed on his fucking fire escape. So this shit was crazy. But that was the grind. You know, I'd take the fucking train and go over there with a bag full of fucking records. And sit there, or actually stand there and watch him show me how to use the EPS 16 plus, the ASR 10, all of that shit. I you know, those are the things that I cherish, you know, and it made me more of the I would say the spokesperson for the Blues Brothers. You know, Norm was laid back. I was the one that was in everybody's face. Like, y'all gonna listen to this shit. I got some come up here with 4 or 5 tapes in a bag and play this shit. And y'all gonna take something off these fucking tapes. And it worked. Every time. Never fail. I don't think there's a placement that we went for that we didn't get. I can't remember one. I can't remember one. And, you know, our most, you know, I would say, outside of Big, you know, I felt that our most accomplished thing that we did was actually working with Old Dirty Bastard. Because at that time, there was no one touching any Wu-Tang records outside of Wu-Tang members, which would be, you know, RZA and was it Fifth Disciple or whoever else it was?
Fourth Disciple, I think.
Fourth Disciple. Yeah, so that was a big monumental thing for us too. You know, being able to do that remix for Old Dirty Bastard, man, it was crazy because, you know, that shit actually had to get okay by RZA.
Okay.
Yeah. So so that shit was monumental. So when I, you know, we got the call back from Dante Ross and shit like, yo, it's a go, I was like, wow. So he must like that shit, like for real, for real. So yeah,
I never thought about that. Dirty was really the only artist that dropped a solo and did have other producers, because he had a track from Neptunes too, as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that's probably why his success was really taken off with that album, man. Because he was reaching in places. He was going here, right. going there.
Getting in places and sections of places where, you know, they wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, me and Mariah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
he was in places that, right, you understand? He was in places that they wasn't. Until Meth did the song with Mary, until Ghost did the song with, he did a song with Mary too, right? I think they both did songs.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But all I have to say is, yeah, he was more than what people thought he was. And that's another shit with that was, you know, I didn't see him the whole time that the remix, you know, whatever was flying off and shit. So we happened to have to go and film a segment for MTV Raps. So we're in the green room. Guess who comes through the fucking door?
Who?
At 8:45 in the fucking morning. A-Son Unique. Here comes Mr. ODB. Now, mind you, he hasn't seen me. He hasn't said, yo, I love that remix or anything. This is the first time he's seeing him. And that has happened now for almost maybe a good 5 months, 6 months since it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we talking and he greets me and says, yo, man, I'm going to thank you that remix is dope. Yo. First thing he says, yo, look, let's go get a 40. Didn't I just tell you it was 8:45 in the morning?
Wow.
Yeah. So we come back with 2 40 ounces. We walk talking about the remix, talking about him and just Wu-Tang in general. And he was like, yo, keep doing the shit you're doing. Yo, you rising. You rising, God. And yo, that was one of the most memorable moments for me. I never expected that at all. You know, I was looking for people to like it. But, you know, to get approval from the actual person and then to get approval from, you know, the founder of this phenomenal fucking group that was on the rise at that time.
The Abbott RZA. Right?
Exactly. So, you know, that was a great thing for me and Norm at that time. You know, Blues Brothers, we did some shit. You know, it's not as much as others, but we did a lot of quality shit. That's the part that I try to say. Did a lot of stuff, but we did a lot of quality stuff too, and things that people wish they could have done and gotten their fucking hands on. But we fell into it. Definitely.
Now, are you still creating music today? And if so, what inspires you nowadays?
What inspires me now is that really me, because I still at my age now, you know, because you know, this is the only culture that puts the age bracket limit, on shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, we got an age limit to it. We the only ones, you know, everything else, rock and roll, this, that, motherfuckers 85 years old, you know, performing with no problem and nobody saying anything. And they got to use more energy than us. They playing instruments and doing all type of shit. But at the same time, you know, we the ones that get this stigmatism of, you know, you get a certain age and then you should be washed up, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, I inspired me by me knowing that, you know, I've learned my lessons. Like being in school for 35 years, if that makes sense. I don't know if Mike can be in school that long, or 40 years. And I've learned all of the lessons. And I know now, you know, when I first started, you know, yeah, I wanted to be aggressive. I wanted to be the rough and rugged, yo, roughing in that voice on the kid, Lord Digger, all of that. But not really understanding that the records are what's going to really drive people. And you got to reach out to different people, different audiences. You know, it takes time to learn certain things, but also at the same time enhancing my craft and getting better at what I wanted to get better at, which was rhyming and making songs. You know, the production part, I could make a beat, give me an SP 1200 and 950, I'll make a track for you in maybe 7 minutes, probably less than that. That's really nothing, but I wanted to master the art of the craft of now being the MC part of it. So it's kind of, you know, people will look at it and say, okay, yeah, well, you know, he's still trying to get on. Like, no, I'm not trying to get on. I've been on. It's the fact that I just sat back and watched the, you know, to watch the landscape and watch the the pulse of the game and still creating, but just not putting out stuff, still writing and doing those type of things. So me, I'm inspired by me knowing that I've actually gotten way better with my craft, in the sense of knowing that I could create something out of nothing and, you know, still be me. I don't have to sell out to anyone and say I got to make these records because I want to get radio play or whatever the fuck that is. But yeah, I think I'm me. I'm my biggest inspiration now, as far as like looking at people that I know that's my age. So if you put it on the age bracket thing and seeing the stuff that they're doing and knowing the stuff that I'm doing, yeah, that I feel that, you know, anybody that I felt that was, you know, had a jump on me or was ahead of me, as far as like just records and of that nature and being acknowledged as an MC, I feel that I've caught up to them now, that I can stand on any stage with anyone now at this point. Anyone. Like, yeah.
And are you working on any specific projects right now?
Yes, I'm working on my, which would be my third release, which the title of the EP is called Jack Tatum. Anybody that's, you know, familiar with sports, football and things of that nature, you know, Jack Tatum was one of the most feared players in the NFL in the mid-70s, early 80s.
Who did he play for?
He played for the Oakland Raiders.
Okay.
He wore number 32, but his original number was 31. He went to college at Ohio State. He was a superior athlete. Really, 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 really fucking good. But he became, you know, like they kind of like shitted on him at the end of his career. You know, he had, in a nothing game, by mistake, he had hit a play and paralyzed him. And a lot of, since that time, you know, they just started looking at him, you know, like, yeah, you know, so they kind of phased him out of the game. But
somebody, yeah.
Yeah. The name of the player was, his name was Darryl Stingley. And actually his son, Darryl Stingley Jr., is playing in the NFL now. But yeah, the title of the album is, the EP is called Jack Tatum. And it's like a, you know, homage to, you know, just hard hitting shit. When you, you know, just the play off that. Anybody that knows,
I get it, yeah,
who Jack Tatum was, yeah. So that's,
was he like the Mean Joe Green of the Raiders or something?
He was one of them. The Raiders had a plethora of fucking dudes that were fucking,
yeah, back in the days, yeah.
One of them. Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the top ones. You know, they also had this guy named Ted Hendricks and Otis Sistrunk. They had a lot of fucking crazy guys, but he was definitely one of the top ones. His partner in crime, George Atkinson, he played beside him, and he was just as vicious as Jack Tatum. Like, Jack Tatum wrote his book, They Call Me Assassin, if anybody want to go and look that up, where he talked about where he was knocking off players' shoes. He was hitting them so fucking hard that he would knock their fucking shoes off. Yeah, so.
So Jack Tatum, you were a big Raiders fan back in the days?
No, I'm a 49er fan for life. I've been a 49er fan since 1982.
That was what, Montana years?
Yep, he came up in Montana, and before that was Jim Plunkett. I became a 49ers fan because of my stepfather was a Dallas fan. So I had to find a team that would, that could play them and make him mad and shit. So, yeah, so I kind of adopted the 49ers by default. Once I knew that that team made him mad, I was like, yep, that's my team, and I've been with them forever. But so I like the Raiders, too, because I like the Raiders because the Raiders are tough.
Yeah, everybody like the colors. Everybody love the colors. So we got this question that we be asking every now and then. Like, if you had an alien come down from whatever planet and you had to play one song to basically tell the story or describe what hip hop is, what song would you play? And somebody actually said, when I first heard this question, they said, what was it? The Biggie song. It was all a dream. Juicy. They said Biggie Juicy. I said Tupac, the old school joint.
Nah, it would have to be. But see, you know, hip hop at one point, the culture, rap is the music mm-hmm. of hip hop.
Yeah.
Hip hop is the culture. It had like two sides. Meaning,
what you mean by that?
Meaning, there was two sides to artists. Either you were going to be ego tripping,
okay,
or you were going to be, I would say, talking about life. Okay. So either you're going to be braggadocious, or you're going to be talking about the things that's going on, right? So. Yeah. For me, if we're going to say, okay, what would be the one thing that alien come down, and I would say I would have to go with the message. Because that's originally how it started. Talking about things that were going, making people aware of the things that were going on around them. You understand?
Yeah.
Message. The messenger, a message telling people what's going on around them and in a rhythmatic form, which now, you know, we go, okay, that's rap music and, you know, this is hip hop. So, yeah, it would probably be the message, definitely.
And if you could go back and give advice to your younger self and about just strictly about the music game, what would it be?
Get paid for everything I do. Everything. I don't give a fuck what it is. If I spit on the sidewalk at an event, y'all want to get paid for that. Like dead ass shoes. It's like whatever. Like whatever it is. Get paid for it. Yeah, because and another thing too, you know, I want to say this. You talk about what influenced me. Let's talk about the people I influence.
Okay.
Let's talk about the name Digga. Where the fuck did that come from before me?
There is Raw Digga and there was Lord Digga. I know. I remember you first.
So, the word Digga is actually a word from the UK or overseas. It's spelled D-I-G-G-E-R. Diggamite is something that, you know, something that's in your... It grows in your toes, like toe fungus and shit. It's a digger mite. But it wasn't spelled how I spelled it. It wasn't, you know what I'm saying? I was the first original person to do this. And it, like I said, my whole name was an acronym. You know, it was Lord Digger. Lord was broken down to lyricist obsessed with rhyming daily. That's what Lord meant. And Digger was distant illustrations going global after life. Like, so it's something that I created from scratch. Even though I've got the name, I saw the name on the back of an album cover, which was a movie, and it was an officer. His name was Detective or Sergeant Digger something, but it wasn't spelled with the A. It was spelled with the D-E, it was spelled with the E-R. And I saw that shit. I think it was either, damn, I can't remember the movie, but it's a black, I don't say exploitation movie, but it's one of them type of movies. I don't know if it was... something up in Harlem or something, but that's where I saw the name at. The Detective Digger or some crazy shit. And that's when I started formulating all this crazy stuff and coming up with that. So what I'm saying as far as inspiration, because I saw, you know, after I did that, there's so many spinoffs of my spelling of my name.
Yeah.
You know, like Grave Diggers. You know, you go and put a Z on it. Now you got Grave Diggers. Then you got Six Figure Digger. That was a producer from Uptown that was... you know, producing for Dipset. And then you had Rod Digger. You know, so there's probably a couple more I'm leaving out. Kurt Digger is a DJ. You know, I never knew that I had to trademark my name. I just thought my name was my name and that was it. Once it was on record, you know, nobody would try to use your name. You know, anybody could be a Lord. You know, it was Lord Finesse, Lord Jamal. It was, you know, that wasn't a thing, but that... my moniker was my name, you know, Digger, made was me. That's who you identify me as. So, you know, I guess my influence is, like I said, you got to get paid for everything. I want to be paid for influencing people to just say, okay, I want to use Digga. You know, if it was that easy, I would have just said, I would call myself KRS-2.
Yeah. And you know, it makes sense because, I mean, I think if you just said the term like Digga in hip hop, I think a lot of people would refer to Raw Digga, not knowing that you actually came before her. I know I would typically, exactly. If I was just like, yo, Digga. And if I was just to say just right. Digga, like I'm about to interview Digga, I guarantee most people will be like, oh, you about to interview Raw Digga? And that, exactly. Yeah, like, nah,
and, that, and that's crazy to me. But you know, it is what it is. But yeah, that would be the thing that I would tell my younger self, like, yo, look, you do this, do that, reverse this, and that could have never happened. But like I said, I never knew I had to do that.
But I got a lot of love for Raw Digga, though, because Raw Digga is actually significant to my life. She was Rampage was the very first show that I ever booked as a booking agent, when I didn't even know that I could book an artist as a booking agent.
Right.
I didn't know any of that shit. Rampage is kind of like, yo, man, I need you to get me a show, and then sent me over this info. Like, you just got to study this info, go holler at a club promoter, and this is all you got to know, man, if he asks questions. And that shit worked like so easy at first until you get into it. Then you start realizing the janky promoters start coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
You know, every show can't go perfect. That's for sure.
Right. All right.
Definitely. Before we let you go, though, man, any shout outs you want to do, man? And sorry, we was running late.
Nah, I ain't worrying about that. This is what now, you know, us artists that's independent and things of that nature that are still have something to give and contribute to the culture. I would have waited 30 minutes. It wouldn't have mattered. You understand? So, you know, you hit me up to do an interview. So that means you have interest in something that I've done in the past, my contribution to hip hop and, you know, the things that I'm doing now, which is I think that, you know, I've grown a lot. And you know, the newer music to me, wow. I'll send you something to your email. I'll send you a motherfucking a WeTransfer.
I actually do music reviews on Saturdays. So if
I'll send you a WeTransfer of fucking just different music, and I tell you right now, and you're talking about shows. That's another thing. I need to get out here to perform. I got music. I got a thumb drive full of fucking music that should be heard. And we're not just talking about any music. We're talking about music. We talking about that shit. Not just shit. Yeah, that's Digga. Oh yeah, that's cool. Nah, it's not. It won't be. Nah, it's just cool. It's some shit that'll move the crowd. What an MC does. That's what I do. I think that my performances, I like performing more than I like recording. I hate going to the studio. Not in a sense of hate like that, but in a sense of, you know, just to get the song out and hear it and all of that. I just want the finished product. I just want to get on stage. Yeah. Like sometimes I'll just go to the studio just to do a rough vocal just to get the TV track. Tell PF Cutting, shout out to my bro PF Cutting, when the East is in the house. I would tell him, yo, look, just do a rough draft real quick. Let's do a rough vocal, and we just mix it good enough. Let's mix it so I can get a TV track of this. And by the time I go to perform this, I'm going to know the song and all of that, so it won't be a problem. I just like performing because I know that feeling. I know what the crowd, especially when you performing some shit that they like and they never heard, and you keep hitting them with some shit, and everybody's, you know, receptive to it. There's no better feeling than that. No better feeling than that. So definitely.
That is the most important part, though, of I think of hip hop or music in general is the performances anyways. It's the best way to really give the fans they want, really get engagement with them, make them leave live like they felt like they really got their money's worth, you know what I'm saying?
Live performance. I'm the master of just switching things. One verse here, two here, go to this, go to some other, yo, listen, listen. Now, I take more pride in that now than anything. And the reason why is because of us being more mature artists now. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to show that I am not labored, or my voice is, my breath control is great. You know, I want to show these things that, yeah, you cannot say, okay, yeah, yo, the older artists, yeah, come on, let's forget about them. Nah,
stop,
you can't
rapping
forget about
after
us.
35. Yeah, that's what they say. Stop
you
rapping
can't forget
after
about
35.
Us. I will bust your little young ass, pause. No fucking Diddy. I will bust your ass on stage. All that jumping around, rhyming over your vocals. We don't do that shit here.
Yeah.
There's only vocals on my track is fucking ad-libs. I don't rhyme over my vocals. I will bust your ass for an hour or more. I'm telling you. Won't even break a sweat. All I need is a bottle of water and a towel. I need a rag just to wipe my face. That's it. I'm good. Yeah, but shout out, you know, man. You know, Team Demo.
Okay.
It's my new production team. I've been with them since like 2002. I've been working with them and, you know, Big Ezo and, you know, yeah. DJ J Ronan, you know, my bro Frank Knight. I'm about to go to his album release, listening party, the Glenvale Project tomorrow. Shout out to Frank Knight. Shout out to my man Ozzy Oz. He did his first event. You know, the other night I was hosting it. Was very, you know, his thing is Swag Dojo, something that he's trying to bring to the culture as well. Shout out to him. Shout out to Bernie that Price and her album that she just released, Widows Cry. You know, the whole Duck Down family 30-year anniversary show coming up. I mean, I should have been a part of that too, but you know, I guess I just get looked over sometimes. I get glazed over like a fucking donut sometimes. But,
you
know, no
production
complaint.
For some of them guys too.
Well, Team Demo did Haram for Sean Price.
Okay.
On the Mike Tyson album.
Oh, okay. That was a dope album.
You know, right in 1996, I was on Duck Down Presents. You forget that, did you?
Nah, yeah. I mean, I know you did so much stuff though, dude. Like y'all producers, y'all done work with so many cats, man.
Yeah, but this was one of the first times that now I'm outside of the IHC.
Yeah,
because IHC was still going on at this time. Yeah, I did a verse on the song on the Duck Down Presents album with Rock Ness and everybody. Yeah, I was one of the. I don't know. I think I was the only one that wasn't signed to Duck Down.
I'm gonna have to go back and listen to that one again.
That Duck Down Presents album. I think it was 1995 or 4.
I remember that joint.
I was the only. I probably the only one that wasn't on Duck Down. It was like one of my. It was crazy. It was funny about it because I remember that day and shit. We went to D&D Studios and
D&D.
As soon as I came out the fucking booth, I walked into like the not for free, but in the sense of whatever he wanted me to do, whether it was for free or not, I was gonna do it because it was Buckshot.
Yeah.
And I love Duck Down. You understand? Yeah. I love everybody that was over there. So I was gonna do it regardless, whether it was for free or not. But in a sense of back then, we talking about like after you do things, you know. It's not the same thing as now, you know, obviously, you know, motherfuckers is cash apping you and, you know, fucking direct deposits and all type of shit.
Yeah.
You know, I was expecting, yeah, okay, you know, come up to the office or something like that. And then he write me a check from the office out of it, something like that.
He already had it ready for you. Yeah.
Right. So that's what I was expecting. You know, not that day. Because I think I went up there. It was like a Friday or Thursday. One of those 2 days. I know it was close to the weekend. So I wasn't expecting that money. Right then and there, you know? So, yeah, that was the shocking part about it. That's when I knew that, you know, Buck was about business.
Business.
Always. Yeah. You know, young business dude, you know, at that time. And, you know, he was rapping and still doing those type of things at that time. So that shit was amazing to me. I was like, damn, I'm on a fucking label. Like, what the fuck? This is fucking genius. So, you know, that part.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out, man. You're more than welcome to come back on anytime, man.
No, you want me to come back on? I'll come back on. We can talk about whatever. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's only we just whatever. But I at the same time, yeah, like, I'm going to send you that music.
Part twos and part threes and stuff like that.
Yeah, whenever you're ready. Say we can say after the after I drop the EP or whatever else. But I'm going to send you music now because, like I said, I need to get linked into some shows. And especially down there, because I've seen some of my people performing down there. I've seen people performing in Greenville, South Carolina. So they trying to do some, they was doing shit out there. So, yeah. And I'm not that expensive, man. Like, I'm not, come on. Like, for real. Like, I'm not charging crazy amount of money. The amount of money I'm charging for the show that you're going to get, it don't even add up. You're like, I should pay them more for that shit. Like, for real. So, yeah.
That's what's up. Well, I'm going to make sure. Well, you got the email, so.
That same email, right?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
All right, no problem. I appreciate you, man, and enjoy the rest of your night, man.
I appreciate you too, Paul. Yo, all I will, man. Go upstairs and probably play some college football.
I know that's right.
Yeah, that's what I do in my pastime, other than writing.
Okay, and I'm going to definitely, anything I see you posting on social media, I'm going to make sure I give it that like and that comment, you know. Help get that engagement.
Yo, thanks, Paul.
All right.
Yes. Vietnam.
Appreciate you, man.
Nigga the Heisman. Appreciate you, man. Salute. Right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Anytime. Peace.
Peace.
Well, there you have it. We was running a little bit late, man. Sorry about that. Basically, StreamYard stopped working a couple hours before I had to go on. And then we also had a breaker that went out like the day before yesterday. We had to have somebody come through and change out the breaker, so they had to cut off the power. But I was only like 10 minutes late. So, but yeah, a lot of interesting stuff in there. I mean, a lot to say about the Master A situation and whatnot. But that's the thing with the business. You know, typically when people have fallouts, it's typically the creative differences. Or money, or both, you know. And he said for him, it was probably both, you know what I'm saying, and whatnot. But definitely, for all y'all cats that are true fans of real hip hop, go back and check out the Master Ace and the INC albums. You had the Slaughterhouse one, and I forgot what the name of the other one was. And just go, you know, Google Lord Digger. And just check out some of the things he's done, you know, on his discography. Check out some of the people he's produced for. Like you said, Biggie One More Chance was probably his biggest record and whatnot. But he also said he produced for ODB, and ODB's album was very, very successful with the freaking food stamp card cover. And I totally forgot that ODB was actually had, like, Neptunes and other producers, which was smart, so your sound just don't be one sound. I understand he was a Wu-Tang artist, but Wu-Tang as a group can have, you know, the Wu-Tang sound, but as a solo artist, you don't necessarily got to have the Wu-Tang sound. You could create your own sound as a solo artist, and then when you go to Wu-Tang, you still do the Wu-Tang sound, but while you're doing Ghostface album or the Raekwon album, you could just create your own sound. It doesn't have to necessarily be Wu-Tang, because when you're a solo artist, your brand is you. You know, GZA brand is GZA. It's not necessarily the Wu-Tang brand. So, yeah, man. Definitely make sure y'all go check out Lord Digger. Let's see what we got coming up. We still got a bunch of interviews on the way. Also, go follow Paul Picker Podcast. I just did 3 interviews on a Paul Pickett podcast. I just did, we did Francesco Ricci, who's going to be fighting in Hollywood, Florida here soon. Steve the Tomahawk Townsend. And we just did Roberto Armas interviews. So go check those out on the Paul Pickett podcast, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, TikTok, Twitter. Also, we got, let's see, what interviews we still got. Tomorrow we got Jay Fliz, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, unsigned independent artist out of Boston or Massachusetts way. Really dope. We still got Pretty P, July 10th. We still got Swayzak of the Goats, June 19th. We still got Michael Myers, June 27th. We still got Hoffa of Killer Army, June 20th. And we got Rex coming back on June 26th with Artisan. And Rex and Artisan are both part of ST the Squad, which is Terminology's little crew as well. So, yeah, we still got a lot of dope interviews on the way. And I just did, what was the last interview? Just so y'all, we just did the interview with my guy from Dizzle, Livio Harris. Go check that out. If y'all don't know, Livio Harris is the guy, or one of the guys actually, who found and produced Idina Howard. And he actually wrote about 80% of the first album for Idina Howard. So definitely go check that out as well. And I'm actually going to, once I get done with this, I'm going to restream on Instagram because I didn't have enough time to link in the Instagram live stream. So we just, right now we're live on Facebook and YouTube. Appreciate everybody that's tuned in, and about to call it a night. Tomorrow I will be doing live music reviews. Probably going to do about 6 or 7 East, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But I appreciate y'all tuning in to another episode of Live from Vietnam. And I'm actually going live on Thursdays now as well, depending on if I got an interview booked on that Thursday. If I don't got an interview for that Thursday, I'm not going to go live. Fridays will always be Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time regardless. And music reviews, I didn't do them last week, but I will be doing them this week, which is tomorrow. Or not tomorrow, but Saturday. So tomorrow we got Jay Fliz. Saturday we got live music reviews. And who knows, maybe Lord Digga send me some tracks. And just so y'all know, Lord Digga actually came out before Raw Digga. So if you say Digga, you know, I know most people think you're referring to Raw Digga, but Lord Digga was actually before Raw Digga. And, you know, you can't forget about who came before you, man. I mean, y'all new generation, y'all can try, but it's not going to benefit you, man. Just trying to block out who came before you, acting like it's just totally irrelevant, like it has no importance whatsoever. But I appreciate y'all tuning in. Another episode, the one and only Paul Masson, and this is Live from Vietnam. Peace. I'm out.